Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We'll hear a panel discussion which followed a special screening of the 2012 documentary film Rosenblatt, The Final Inning, produced by Nebraska Educational Television and directed by Sue Marriott. The members of the panel will include Lou Spry, official scorer at the College World Series from 1981 to the present, Jack Payne, the voice of the College World Series, and PA announcer at Rosenblatt Stadium from 1964 to 2000, Steve Rosenblatt, son of former Omaha Mayor Johnny Rosenblatt, after whom the stadium was named, Augie Garrido, University of Texas head baseball coach, and Gene Stevenson, Wichita State University head coach. In heartwarming style, Rosenblatt, The Final Inning, follows the efforts of Omaha Mayor Johnny Rosenblatt to build Omaha's municipal stadium in the mid-1940s, with the first game played within its stadium walls in 1948. The stadium was later dedicated as Johnny Rosenblatt Stadium in 1964 in honor of the former mayor's efforts. Over the years, Rosenblatt has hosted football, concerts, wrestling, fireworks, and lots of baseball, including hardball action from AAA teams, the Omaha Cardinals, Omaha Dodgers, and Omaha Royals, as well as the best of the collegiate best in the College World Series. Not only is the ballpark's history traced, but the film introduces the personalities that have become as much a part of Rosenblatt Stadium as the concrete, grass, and dugouts. Home of the College World Series since 1950, the final CWS game was played at Rosenblatt on June 29, 2010, with the South Carolina Gamecocks defeating the UCLA Bruins. With the construction of a new ballpark, Rosenblatt has become a ghost. With its destruction nearly complete to make room for more parking for the Henry Dorley Zoo, for baseball fans across the country, it has been like losing a best friend. Rosenblatt, The Final Inning, is a production of NET Television and has been accepted for national distribution by the National Educational Telecommunications Association. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, June 20, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the panelists and do not necessarily represent those of the Durham Museum, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the program is the film's producer and director, Sue Marriott.
I'm going to go ahead and introduce our panel now, and we're going to open it up for questions, and you can ask these guys anything you want. So I'm going to start here on the left. Lou Spry, the official scorer. I think we cleared the record. He is not the guy that ended Robin Ventura's hitting streak. Maybe the second baseman that bobbled the ball did. Jack Payne, PA announcer for many, many years at Rosenblatt. If any of you spent time out there, you came to know his voice, came to know his style, and I really do feel like Jack was one of the guys that gave Rosenblatt that homey feel that everybody came to love. Steve Rosenblatt, sitting here in the middle, as you might guess, he has a little connection to the place. Steve is Johnny Rosenblatt's son, like his dad. He's also played a little baseball, dabbled in some politics. apple didn't fall far from the tree. And Steve is still very active here in the Omaha community, and he's working with the folks at the Henry Dorley Zoo on what I guess, I don't know if they're calling it the Rosenblatt Memorial.
Johnny Rosenblatt's infield at the zoo.
He's working closely with the folks on the plans for that. I've seen some of it, and I think it's really going to be great. Then these two characters on the end. If I read the resumes of these two, we wouldn't make it to the game tonight. So I'll keep it brief, but we have the two winningest coaches in the NCAA with us today, which I am thrilled about. They have been great sports through the process of making this film, and just really good guys to work with. I joke with them a bit. Augie, I say that you're the guy that Nebraska fans love to hate. Gene, I say you're the guy that Creighton fans love to hate. That said, they've both been incredible to the community of Omaha, and their resume speaks for itself. They're incredible coaches. And I think with the passing of Rod Dato, we've got the two new mayors of Omaha here. So this is the panel. You guys, if you have questions, if you want to raise your hand. Does anybody have questions right off? If you raise your hand and Mick will get to you. Uh-oh, Brian the editor. He yeah. saw it all in the edit room. And he's
I just
the one
had
that...
to watch you guys all the time. And look at your faces all the time for like, I don't know, if it was 3 or 4 months we were editing. But so now I get to ask the questions that I wanted to ask the whole time. I guess for our coaches, I wonder, Augie Garrido, how you feel when you watch that TCU scene when they made it and you didn't. And then I wonder for Gene Stevenson how you feel rewatching The Grand Illusion.
Well, as far as I think what the College World Series offers everyone in the country, there's over 300 teams, I think, Lou, that start in Division I that are on the journey toward Omaha. And I know from the reaction of our players as far back as 1979 and the Tim Wallachs and the guys that played on those teams, and I'm sure Gene would echo this part of it, there's a certain sadness when you fail, when we do fail, and especially to a rival because of the way our fans react. But as professionals, we understand that the life-changing kinds of things that go on here that you have developed here in the city with this CWS is going to be as meaningful for the players on that team as it is for the players on our team. And it always can't be about the glory that comes your way. And as professionals, I think we, and as teachers, we recognize that as much as we hate to share, we absolutely have to. And so there is a good feeling knowing that their lives are going to be changed for the better as a result of what you do here. Gene, now it's your turn.
Yeah.
The illusion.
The illusion. Here we go. Yeah.
So give them the David Copperfield
speech. Wow. I think I said it all in that little the movie. I will say this, you know, that there have been so many memories here during the Rosenblatt era for us, and you know, to highlight the most embarrassing time would, you know, is not really fun for me. But that team, that was the fourth year of us starting the program. And in Wichita, there hadn't been a team there before, and there had not been a field or any place to practice or anything. And to see what it is today is fantastic in Wichita. But that team in 1982 would have even been better. We won 73 games. I think Augie will attest that we played him in the first round. We shut him out, and they were a great team. I mean, but that team was phenomenal, and I know we were the best team in Omaha. But, you know, you still have to win it on the field. And we won 73 games that year. We played everybody that would play us anywhere in the country, and that team was minus Joe Carter, who would have been a senior on that team. He signed, I don't know why, but he was only the second player picked in the whole country in the first round the year before. We also lost seven other guys that signed as underclassmen the year before. So, but fortunately for us, on that team, four guys came back that had been drafted, and they all had pretty good careers. One of them, my brother Phil, that you saw, had wound up stealing 87 bases that year, but it was the one that he got caught stealing that is the one that you guys get to see all the time. And Jim Thomas, who's now an assistant for us and played 9 years of professional baseball, was another guy who came back for his senior year. Charlie O'Brien, who spent 16 years in the big leagues, caught more Cy Young Award winners than any other catcher in the history of baseball, came back for his senior year. And Don Heinkel, who Phil and my brother Phil and Don Heinkel are both in the College Baseball Hall of Fame. Those four guys came back for their senior year, so they gave us a crew that gave us a little bit of experience to start with, and the rest of them filled in. It was a great year, and we were in the championship game. That game in particular was not the championship game. It was the first round, the second round of the winner's bracket, and they were afraid that we were going to be able to steal, and I think I said it all. I mean, I noticed right from the first go around that he did a lot of step offs to pick at first, and had no success, and they picked and picked and picked and picked and picked anytime we got a guy on first. That game that probably should have been over in about 2 hours and 10 minutes lasted 3 hours and 40 minutes, I think, and a lot of it was over the picks. But It was a fantastic, they said it all. I mean, it was hard to see at that particular moment. It was right at dusk. There were a lot of difficult things going on at the same time. And not the least of which, in those days, you notice I was in the dugout. I had a graduate assistant coaching third, and I had a player coaching first. And that player was drafted in the first round. It was the guy that shut you guys out, Brian Elkers. And he was counting his money because he was the fourth pick in the draft. And he didn't really pay attention. And when somebody hollered ball from the dugout, he turned and hollered ball to our first base guy, Phil. And Phil keeps looking back to see the ball. And I was looking for the ball because the girls were running down there away from it, you know, the bat girls for Miami. So I thought, wow, this is going to be great because nobody can find the ball, but we're going to wind up at third probably. And sure enough, it just Kasper Zach picked himself up off the ground and just calmly tossed the ball over to Billy Rona, who was a first-year player at Miami from Tulsa his younger brother later played for us at Wichita State. So it was a whole family affair, my golly. And, you know, we were just excluded from it, me and my brother. So anyway, it is what it is. It's part of the folklore of Rosenblatt and the College World Series. Unfortunately, one of the great players who ever played college baseball, my brother Phil, takes the brunt of it. And, you know, the guy that was coaching him, you're looking at him, and he's not any smarter today than he was then.
Gene brings up something that I've always wondered with these coaches, because you guys talk about players that you've had that maybe you're going to go get drafted early. You know, obviously that's kind of your job to get them into the majors. But when you get the news that they are going to go early and you're thinking, okay, well, there's next season for me. And so when a player delivers that news to you, what's your mindset? Because obviously it's going to affect your next season.
Well, I'm always glad for the player because he wouldn't be taking it if he didn't think it was a great thing for himself and his opportunity. My only concern is that when we talk to players about this is that when you go, that you need to be ready to succeed. Because you only get one chance, you need to be ready to succeed and be your best. And so, unfortunately, a lot of guys, and I know Augie would attest to this, go out before they're ready to succeed, and they have, as far as succeeding in pro ball, and they wind up in a position they might have been able to make it in the big leagues had they stayed another year in college, but they weren't quite ready emotionally or physically or mentally to deal with the situation. A lot of guys, you know, at Wichita State have gone on and played and had good careers in the major leagues. And unfortunately, a lot of them that I thought had real talent may have left a little early. And then they put themselves in that position where they couldn't quite get there. But, you know, I'm happy for the player, and I know that each year it just opens up another opportunity for another young player in the program or a group of players to step up and do well. It's a tough job. I mean, Lord, look at the two of us, you know? I mean,
think we're only 26 years old.
And it's something I wouldn't change anywhere in the world. I think coaching college baseball to me is the greatest thing in the world because you get to work with young men and you have more influence over those guys in those 3 or 4 years that you have them than even their own parents have. And I think that, you know, a lot of people envy that, but it's a huge responsibility for those of us that do that job. And we don't take it lightly. I know that. And it's something that you see guys develop and become great young men who have responsibility and accountability and go out and become really good husbands, good parents, good citizens that do a great job in being the future leaders of this country. And so I think it's the most phenomenal opportunity for us as coaches than anything I can think of.
Sue, let me add one thing about the grand illusion. I don't know, Gene hasn't mentioned this, and he may not know it, but I've talked to Ron Frazier about it, and the reason they were having the pitcher step off the rubber before he threw was to influence Dale Williams, who was the first base umpire, and also a Super Bowl referee, or a linesman, I mean, they were trying to get it in his head that he was going to do that all the time, so that when they actually pulled the play, he wouldn't throw up his hands and holler balk. And that was the purpose of that, and it obviously they educated Williams very well.
Okay, I think Gene's done with the grand illusion, so we'll move on. Please raise your hand if you have a question, because I'll go all day with these guys. As you're delivering, I'm going to ask something quick. Something that amazed me in interviewing all of you and some of the other folks is the incredible memory that you all seem to have. And you saw it as we were editing it. They would describe a play, and then Brian and I would go into the edit suite, get the footage from the NCAA, and I mean, to the point of where the sun was in the sky and where the, I mean, you remember every detail, it seems, and this is all of you. So I want to know, is your memory this good in the rest of your lives, or is it just with baseball? Uh-oh. Steve's going to jump in on this.
I think when you think about memories in baseball, baseball is almost like life is baseball and baseball is life. And there are things that happen. The worst thing that ever happened to me on a baseball field, I can tell you to this what the temperature was that day. And so I think you never forget those things. And I won't get into that thing that happened to me, because the most embarrassing thing that ever happened to me maybe I'll tell you about it. You might get a kick out of this. I was a sophomore in high school at Central High School, not far from here. Second game of my baseball career in high school, I didn't start, but the coach brought me in the third inning, take over for the second baseman who had beaten me out, show you what kind of a ball player I was. He only had one eye, and he beat me out. But in the second inning, the coach had seen enough. Rosenblatt, you're in there. A couple innings later, somehow or another, I got on first base and advanced to second. We had runners on first and second, nobody out, and our number three hitters at bat were down 2-0. Now, these guys might have some differences of opinion. It's probably a bunt situation. Maybe it's not. But the fact of the matter was, this was our number three hitter, big power hitter, and the coach puts on the bunt sign. It's 35 degrees that day. We have the wrestling team's sweatsuits on so we don't freeze to death. That's what playing baseball in Omaha is like that time of year. The guy squares the bunt. First pitch goes by is no problem. He didn't offer at it. Now, the ground was muddy that day. When you're playing baseball in Omaha and it's 35 degrees and it's April 10th, field's not too good. The next pitch, he squares the bunt. He makes the move to bunt. The ball goes right by him. I took my secondary lead off of second base because I wanted to make sure I got to third base. Catcher sees me slip in the mud. He throws to second base and they nail my rear end. I was picked off. At that point in time, we had been playing Benson High School. I wanted to head to the Benson dugout. I was a little bit afraid. Now, our coach, who's still alive, and here's the most interesting story of the whole part of the story. Our baseball coach at Central High School was a fellow named Jim Karabatsis. In the first game ever played at Rosenblatt with the professionals that you saw that day, he was playing minor league baseball, came in as a pinch hitter, got a base hit, and he's 1-for-1 at Rosenblatt, 1,000 batting average, and he's still alive to this day. He had words for me, folks, when I got back to that dugout, you've never heard before. And as I say, we never forget some of those memories. Now you've heard the words.
Okay, we got a question up here.
Gene, I have two questions for you. What kind of year did the kids from Millard have, and what is their future? And the second question is, if I recall, I think you accepted a job at Oklahoma at one time, and then about 24 hours later, you backed out. Why?
Oh, God. Boy, when I said unfiltered.
I'm just here to help you.
All right, yeah. So what was that first question again?
The young men from Millard, I think it's A.J. Ladwig and the other young man from Millard North. I think he's your first baseman and lefty pitcher.
Well, yes. I mean, all three of those guys were freshmen this year that came from up from Nebraska, and they've all contributed greatly. We're going to be a very formidable team, I believe, next year. Somewhat to the because of those three, they're going to get much better. That's Casey Gillespie. He's Connor Gillespie's younger brother, and Taylor Doggett is from Lincoln and is a very good outfielder, good runner, and surprisingly a good hitter. A.J. Ladwig is a right-handed pitcher that's going to be an exceptional pitcher in college and had good games this year. It's just, coming from this kind of environment, it takes a while for those guys to catch up to the people from Texas or the people from Florida and where they play the year-round. They have really good coaches. The opportunities to play, in this state are not as often as they are in Florida and Texas and California and so forth. So, but they're catching up, and they're going to catch up quickly. So, and the other question? Oh, I heard it. I know. You don't have to ask. I had several opportunities over the years to go other places. The one thing that really is unique about Wichita and Wichita State is that we started that program from nothing, and there wasn't even a baseball. There wasn't a practice field. There wasn't anything. It's almost like, raising a family and starting there and being special. And the times that I almost, if I said there was any job I would go to, it would be the University of Oklahoma because I had coached there, from 72 to 77. And we spent 5 years in a row coming to College World Series at that time. And I took this job at Wichita and thought, my gosh, we can make this into something special. Now, I'm not the smartest guy in the world, and so I give some of you some insight as to why I'm not the smartest. I was coaching as assistant in baseball at Oklahoma those 5 years. My salary at that time was $25,000 a year when I chose to leave. I was recruiting football for Barry Switzer at Oklahoma because I had played some football at Missouri. And by the way, I might have been the third guy that ever played here. On 64, I was a freshman at Missouri. They didn't allow freshmen to play then, and I darn sure would have started. But they came here and were runner-up that year in 64. But in 65 and on, we'd never quite made it. We did beat Steve Arlen, though, at Ohio State, so I want you to know that. But anyway, boy, I get on sidetracks. I just say that I felt like that from coming from those humble beginnings at Wichita, where I was hired for the lofty sum of $1,000 a month, 1 month at a time. And how smart I am? I came here, I had no, in Oklahoma, I had free clothes for our family. I had new car every 6 months, had football tickets that were probably worth more than my salary. And the thing about it was, is it came to Wichita for no clothes, no car, $1,000 a month. But I had an athletic director that promised me all the football tickets I could ever want. And I thought, well, hell, they're going to be as valuable as they were at Oklahoma. And I didn't know the difference. They couldn't give them away at the local supermarket. So, I'm not a very smart guy, but I chose to go there because I thought we could build something special and build a dream. And we were able to do that. And, God works in strange ways sometimes, and you think you're doing the right thing for the right reasons. And when I chose to take that job for 8 hours, I think it was for the wrong reasons. It was for more money. It was for the other things that I can't go into. But I'll just say this, that when I saw what was there and the situation, the difficulties that they would have put me under were not what I could do. I'm not going to say exactly what the situation was, but it was impossible for me to deal with. And I think that I was being shown that you need to stay where you are, because Wichita had become home. You know, I grew up in Guthrie, Oklahoma, and I'd gone coaching at Oklahoma University, and so I thought that was it. You know, that's what I wanted to do. But, you know, Wichita became home. My kids were growing up there, grandkids there, everything's there, and it was a great situation. I still believe we can come back to Omaha and play in the College World Series, and I still believe we can win. So I may be the only guy on the planet that believes that, but I think we can. So basically that's why I stayed.
You made the right decision. In 72, you coached about Randy Fizell and Joe Simpson, huh?
That's true. Yes, that's right. And I won't say this while you're mentioning that. In 1973, the best player I ever saw, we played against right here in the College World Series, opening game. Jackson Todd was pitching for us, who later pitched in the major leagues. And we had Joe Simpson playing center field. He also played in the major leagues. And the dugouts were a lot lower in those days. You had to look up over the top. And this guy was pitching against us, who threw the one-hitter and struck out, whatever he said, 14 in the opening game. That was against us. And he also hit a ball that was the hardest ball I ever saw hit with a wood bat. I'm in the dugout, and I see it go off the bat. You remember, it was 420 in center field in those days with a 10-foot-high fence. This ball with a wooden bat went off through the infield. If it had hit our shortstop, which luckily it went to his left, it would have taken his knees out. That ball was just screamed like I'd never seen hit. And the ball carried. Joe Simpson was playing 400 feet away because this guy had some power. And that one hop, the center fielder, for a single. And I thought, my gosh, this is a man-child beyond belief. And he was also, we also had tying and winning runs on in the ninth inning, and he blew three strikes by guys like you've never seen it. Dave Winfield was the best college pitcher and player I ever saw. And I'll say that without question. And if he had chosen to be a pitcher, like Bob Gibson had chosen to be a pitcher instead of a hitter, Dave Winfield would have been one of the great pitchers of all time in Major League Baseball. He was 5-0 the first spring training that he went out, and then decided he'd spend all his time being a hitter. So that was a memorable experience for me, you know, in 73. You bring that up, so I could talk forever. I'm sorry.
I'm going to ask a question that I may have to exclude the coaches on. I'll leave it up to you. Of all the baseball you saw at Rosenblatt, if you could pick one player that hands down was the most talented player you ever saw, and the reason I say I would exclude you guys, it's up to you. For you guys, it's like picking a kid. But if you want to answer, you can.
Bo Jackson.
Absolutely.
Jack?
Bo Jackson.
Well, best player you ever saw at Rosenblatt?
Dave Winfield.
Talking about at the series?
You know, it could be Royals, too, or anything.
I think I'd have to say Winfield, and I have a similar thought to the one that Gene expressed. At the time that I was the tournament manager and was sitting along the third base side in the box seat, and Winfield hit a ball to left field that I swear was a straight line. There wasn't any arc to it. And I swear it didn't clear the fence by more than 5-10 feet at the most. I mean, it looked like it was going to go forever. And these are things that that probably enhanced over the years. But I actually thought it was still going up when it got to the fence. I don't know if you remember that, Gene. That was in the same tournament, and he just tomahawked the thing, and the pitch was up here. It wasn't a pitch that was, right down the middle and waist high and something like that. He was swinging at a pitch that was clearly out of the strike zone, just up here. And just, oh.
Quick question for, or if you guys want to answer, go ahead. We'll pass the mic down, please.
All right. Now, and I'll say this, that that Fred Lynn told me that, who was on that team for Southern Cal that year, that they played in the final with Minnesota, and Dave Winfield was on the mound. And he went nine innings, or close to, within one or two outs of nine innings. I think it was two outs. And had them shut out like 7-0, 8-1, something like that. Fred Lynn said they were done, and it was the championship game. And Dick Siebert came out and took Winfield out of the game.
No, Siebert didn't go out.
He did not go out. Who did?
Siebert got chased by Gene Agnes, the first base umpire, in the last of the eighth on a bang-bang play at first base, which I always thought was the reason that they didn't do so well, because Chief could have gone out and calmed him down maybe and would have done things a little differently. I don't remember who the assistant was, but the
well, anyway, Fred told me, was telling me the story. We would already eliminated. We were gone. But and in those days, it wasn't televised, see, so. But he said it was the most exciting game he ever played, including all the games in major leagues and all the things he ever did. And they came back with two outs. They made a change, a pitching change, and they were down by 6 or 7 runs, and they came back, and they never got another out. And they came back and won the game 9-8, 8-7, something, whatever.
8-7.
And it was just Fred Lynn's the most exciting game he ever was in.
I think that was the game that Winfield went out, went to left field.
Outfield.
And then they wanted to bring him back in the pitch. He says, no, I've had, you know.
Well, that's the story, yeah.
They went out and talked to him, and
right. he didn't want
he said.
Fred Lynn said they could never have hit him. Fred Lynn said they could never have hit Dave Winfield. If they had brought him back in, or if they had never taken him out, it was over. But that's what happened.
Talent like he had, the ability to go on and play professional basketball, the ability to go on and play professional football, chose baseball, wound up in the Hall of Fame, and the characterism of different ball players that come in here to play in the series every year. We look at the statistics and we look at the background, we read this, we hear about that, and you never know about what the outcome is going to be for an individual until he comes to play at the plate in the College World Series. That's where the light goes on in the College World Series. And Dave had I think he gave up one hit and had about 14, 15 strikeouts. Then he did go to left field, and as Steve said, he chose not to go back to the mound. And through the years, as you look back on all of the talent, golly, that's come through the College World Series out here, and the playing ability of a lot of these people, we had a fellow named Kotze. Did it ring a bell, Augie?
Mm-hmm. Mark Kotze.
Yes, Mark Kotze.
Yeah.
Okay. I placed Mark Kotze number 2 in my pick for people that I admired the most playing in the College World Series of the thing.
I've got a quick question for Steve. As you saw on the show, Steve shared memories of sitting in the dugout with major leaguers, going up to the booth and announcing for Satchel Paige. In the course of growing up out of that ballpark and being with your dad out there, did you have any idea as a kid these moments and how great they were as they were happening to you and how important this stadium would become to so many people?
Well, when the series got started, it obviously did not have the recognition that it had today. It was nurtured, and because of some good people, the NCAA, the Deesings within our community here, businessmen, coaches like these guys, players like we've talked about, brought it to what it is. But as a 10, 11, 12-year-old kid, I don't think I was able to grasp what it would turn into. I don't know that anybody at that time knew. I think everybody had high expectations. But there's a great deal of difference between what college baseball was in 1950 and what it has developed into today, not only from the standpoint of the national nature of it, but the level of talent that's now playing collegiate baseball today is tremendously enhanced from the years when Bib Fuck. Many of you folks wouldn't know this, but in 1950, the first year of the College World Series, Bib Fuck was the head coach of Texas.
Right.
They won the College World Series that year. I believe they had two people on that ball club that went on to play in the major leagues. One was a pitcher by the name of Murray Wall.
Still alive.
And another one was a second baseman. He was a good buddy of mine, and it'd show you how my age is going. He played for the Yankees a little bit.
Cal Segrist,
exactly.
And he's still alive.
So there were two players from the first team that played in the College World Series that made it to the big leagues. In 1978, Rod Dedeaux had perhaps, a bit different opinions, the greatest college team ever assembled. 78, they won the championship, and I believe 13, somewhere between 11 and 13 of those young men made an appearance in Major League Baseball. But that just goes to show you how the level of talent that the people here today are getting to see in its transition to Major League Baseball is happening. So the answer to your question, Sue, I'd like to tell you, yeah, I thought it was going to be terrific like it is today with the new stadium and all that good stuff. But the answer was no, because I was a little short-sighted. But I will tell you this. College baseball has become one of the great traditions in the country. We, who had the name Rosenblatt, were glad to be a part of it. And as we go down the road, new traditions will occur. New things will happen at TD Ameritrade. And baseball and college will begin to grow even more than it has been. And I want to just say one thing before I shut up. I'd like to see all of those folks who are here give Sue a great hand, because she produced one of the great documentaries in college baseball history.
Sue, if I may please, I came to Omaha in 1951. The series came in 1950. And my last year on the mic was 2000. I had 50 years operation with the College World Series, 47 of it on the PA. And working with individuals in the press box, behind the scenes, what goes on, sports information writers, and back in the 50s, early 50s, when you looked at a coach and asked where the sports information director was, he probably pointed to his hip pocket. He may have had all the details in there. But I had the pleasure of working those years, and through three press boxes, five organists, and working with a lot of people. But one of the most pleasant men I ever worked with up there was Lambert Bartak. And he unfortunately lost his wife just recently. And I would have hoped that he would have been at this table tonight, today talking to us maybe. But we were sitting in the lunchroom one day, and head of the game, and Lambert said that he was puzzled. He didn't know what he was going to do. He did not have the sheet music for Oklahoma State, and I of course, through the years in broadcasting the games, I had some experience being a graduate of the University of Oklahoma. And I told him, I said, well, I can tell you what the song is. And I said, I don't know if it'll help you or not. And he said, okay. And I said, it goes like this. Ta-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. That was the song of Oklahoma State. da-da-da-da-da. And Lambert says, wait a minute. And he got out a napkin, and he got out a pencil, and he sat there and he said, now don't go too fast. He said, do it just like you did. And so I hummed OSU that way, and he went back to the booth and he played it for the game that day. And that's how he got that on the thing. But just, it's a wonderful thing to look back on the years that you had. A lot of fun. People, just go with it, go out, have fun, enjoy the game, and remember, it's who's on the field that counts when you go to the College World Series.
Jack brought up Lambert. I have a quick Lambert story, and then I'll get to your question. Lambert, we knew we wanted to tell the Mickey Mouse story, and much like the Grand Illusion, it was a story that Lambert didn't really want to talk about. And also, Lambert's just a very private guy. He got to be well-known once TV got introduced out at Rosenblatt, and then they started putting him on the big screen, and I think when the crowd realized there's this adorable guy up in the booth playing the organ, then he became a fan favorite. He would have much rather, I think, just quietly gone in, done his music gig, and gone home to his wife, Jerry, for the night. At the last series at Rosenblatt, I had gotten to know Lambert over the years because I did some work with the NCAA on the big screen production when they first brought it into Rosenblatt, and our booth was attached to Lambert's organ booth. So I got to know him in those years. So when we started doing this show, I carefully started asking him about the Mickey Mouse scandal and would he maybe play the song for us. Come to find out, he never played that song again after that incident and after he got thrown out of the stadium. So after much pleading with him and a pretend call to the NCAA to show him that it was okay to play it, because he says, oh, I don't know, I don't think they'd let me, I don't think I should. And I said, no, you know what, I'm going to call Denny Pope real quick and just make sure. And I pretend called Denny, because of course the NCAA was going to be fine with him playing it as long as there wasn't a scuttlebutt happening on the field, and I was watching to make sure that wasn't happening. He very cautiously played it for us. So when you hear the music, that is the one and only time since him being thrown out of the game that he has played that song, and he was looking over his back the entire time and was very nervous about it. So Lou, for your what were the factors that led to you becoming the official scorer? And you might share with them also your Lou has a connection to the NCAA.
Well, that's the main answer. I started scoring when I graduated from high school. I actually started getting paid for it in 1953. I told a manager that in professional sports that one time who was probably about 40 years old, and I'd been scoring longer than he'd been managing and than he'd been alive. But the genesis of me getting there is I came to the NCAA in 1966 as the publications editor, and I for 5 years I was the media coordinator here at the College World Series, 67 through 71. And then a fellow some of you may remember, I don't know, Gene Duffy, who was the associate director of athletics at Creighton, and I had been working on the College World Series, and Gene passed away of cancer in early 72. And one of the things that you don't turned down is Walter Byers when he says to do something. And so he wanted me to take over management of the World Series, and I did that from 72 to 79, and then he insisted that I give it up. I was the chief financial officer at the time, and he said that if you mess up the bracket of the World Series, I'll have to explain that to the executive committee. But if you mess up our money, that's a lot tougher for me to explain, so you're going to quit. And I said, all right, may I start as the official scorer then? And he said, yes, if you sit out a year. So I had to sit out 1980. This will be my 45th series, but it's not consecutive. So I sat out in 1980 and started scoring in 81. That sounds like a good deal, except, as Mama will attest, I've been taking vacation time all those years. I was never on the NCAA nickel as the official scorer. I had to take my vacation time to come up and do that. And as I've been searching for someone, basking as I am in the twilight of a mediocre career, as I've been searching for someone to recommend to take my place, who wants to do that? I haven't found anybody that I thought was qualified that was willing to take 2 weeks off now and come up here to score the College World Series. So that was how I got there. And I guess you'd say I had the inside track. The boss was going to, as long as I took vacation, he wasn't going to pay me to come up here. And as long as I took vacation time, I had the job. And when Dennis Pope became the tournament manager in 87, he said the job was mine as long as I wanted it. So that's how I got there. I did have the background at the time, having scored in the Texas League and the American League, but you would have to say that I had an inside track to getting the job to start with. And I retired from the association in 1999, but I've continued to score since then.
I think I said we had one more question up here. Actually, we'll take these last two guys, and I think we need to wrap up. So,
I have a real quick question for you, Lou Spry. We don't have any umpires up here on the panel, so my question would be: do you see the potential for instant replay at the College World Series baseball?
Unfortunately, I have to say the answer is yes. It is my personal view that instant replay equipment should be put in a huge crater and demolition equipment attach thereunto and blow it all to various and sundry locations off of this planet.
Could we put the beach balls in there too?
Oh yeah. Good thought, Woggy. My feeling about instant replay is that the games are played by men. They are coached by men. And they are officiated by men, and they're all going to make mistakes. Now, Gene and Augie aren't going to like this, but it's always been my view that in any one game, if the officials make no more mistakes than the teams and the players, turn that around. If the players make no more mistakes and the coaches make no more mistakes than the officials, it'll be a great game. Everybody makes mistakes. Gene and Augie will tell you that they've made some. Not very many, because they've won a heck of a lot of games, but they've made some. I just don't think instant replay adds to any game. I don't like it in football. But having said all that, I think, yes, I think that instant replay is going to become more a part of it, of baseball, and I wonder where they're gonna let it come in. Now, right now, the College World Series, it's my understanding, uses instant replay to determine whether or not a home run went out of the park or a ball went out of the park. And they should have used it the other day when a fan reached down and touched a ball that was in, caught a ball that was in play, and they scored it as a they ruled it a ground rule double. But in my opinion, it would have fan interference and probably should have had another base. I'd like to hear what Gene and Augie have to say about that, but I just don't. In baseball, there's too many factors. Where do you stop instant replay? God help us if we go to instant replay on balls and strikes. And so, it, you know, I guess you could have instant replay. I mean, on safe out calls and on traps and catches. I mean, the opportunities are endless for instant replay. I just don't think it's a thing to do. But, you know, there's more and more technology assaulting us every day, and I think that we're probably going to see more of it. I hope I'm not upright that long.
Because we had one more question, and then we'll wrap it up and give these guys a big hand.
I've been coming to this series since the 60s, and I hope my memory serves me correctly this time when I recall this. But this question is for Augie, and I think you had a team here about 25 years ago, and you kicked the ball around a little bit one game. And in preparation for your next game, I'd like you to talk about how you took infield practice. Do you remember what I'm talking about?
Without the ball?
Yeah.
We made less errors. I like that. So we did a phantom infield, and the fungo hitter would go through the infield routine. We went through the whole infield routine without a ball, and we really did well. Didn't make any errors.
Augie, did you do that before or after the L.A. State?
You know, really, as a result of L.A. State, though, because they did it all the time.
Yeah.
And we were in the same conference at that time. So we saw them during the regular season. So I haven't had an original idea in a long time. But that is what we did. We wanted 100% success prior to that game. And we got it. We found a way to get it.
Okay. It was about 25 years.
Yeah, I don't know. I want to say one thing about, I started to tell this story when we were talking about Bib Falk. Texas, with Bib Falk, won in 49 the year before Rosenblatt.
Yeah, before.
Yeah, and then they won in 1950. Mm-hmm. And for Gene, myself, all the other coaches, another way of telling you how meaningful this College World Series is to all of us out there and to the people we come in contact with. We have a room where the players, it's kind of a multi-purpose room, but the pregame meals are there. It's the Omaha room. It's got a picture of the statue in it. It's got all the pictures and the uniforms from Bib Falk and so on, and it's the Omaha room. And there are things like that going on in locker rooms, in the batting cage areas all over the country with Omaha in some way, shape, or form. We also dedicated the 49-50 team. We had them at the ballpark this year, and we created a uniform copied from their pictures to honor Omaha and the national championships from 1949 and the first one ever in Omaha, 1950.
Augie, thanks. I think Jack has one closing thought.
Augie.
Yes, sir.
How did you become friends with Kevin Costner?
Ah. Oh, my. It's a hard story to tell because there's a... He was a student at Cal State Fullerton. I'll make this as brief as I can. And he sat outside of the... We had just chain link... ballpark, and we didn't have anything like dugouts or anything. It was just like playing a recreational field. And So the president of the university got a call, called Kevin after he made the movie Field of Dreams and Bull Durham and Dances with Wolves. So he was a big star at this point. And he went to Fullerton. The president asked him if he would come to the dedication of our new baseball field. Build it and they will come. And that's what you've done here, by the way. And he said, on one condition, that I have a private meeting with Coach Garrido. And so the president called me for the first time ever and said, and told me that. And I, he said, do you know what that's about? I said, no. I don't know him. I know of him, but I don't know him. So that meeting took place. And what he told me was astonishing for any of you school teachers that might be out there or anybody that comes in contact in any way of mentoring. We never know how we're affecting the people around us and how much we mean. And that's why we have to give thanks to all of you and everyone in this room for what you do and never get a thank you back for it. You mean more to more people than you ever know. And Kevin came back to thank me for what he had heard by sitting outside the dugout, listening to me talking to the players. I was the second most important person in his life besides his dad. And that is what we're all doing in this society. And he was aware of what that might mean, and we've been best friends ever since. However, the way that affected me, it gave me a different level of self-esteem and confidence in knowing that I could do things and that I mattered. I mattered more than I knew. And I think that's what I'd like to share with all of you. You matter more than you know to more people than you know by what you've done here.
Great.
You've been listening to a program from the Durham Museum Lecture Series on Noon Forum. We've heard a panel discussion which followed a special screening of the 2012 documentary film Rosenblatt, The Final Inning, produced by Nebraska Educational Television and directed by Sue Marriott. The members of the panel have included Lou Spry, official scorer at the College World Series from 1981 to the present, Jack Payne, the voice of the College World Series, and PA announcer at Rosenblatt Stadium from 1964 to 2000, Steve Rosenblatt, son of former Omaha Mayor Johnny Rosenblatt, after whom the stadium was named, Augie Garrido, University of Texas head baseball coach, and Gene Stevenson, Wichita State University head coach. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Wednesday afternoon, June 20th, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Shauna Forsberg, Director of Marketing and Public Relations at the Durham Museum, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. The next program at the Durham Museum will be tomorrow evening, Tuesday, September 25th at 6:30. At that time, Spencer Davis, professor of history at Peru State College, will present the third in his four-part lecture series, The American Civil War, a look back 150 years ago. His topic will be A First Turning Point, August to September 1862. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.